From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, deadly attacks in the DRC. We'll have the latest on the Ebola outbreak, Islamic State and peace in the broader Middle East, plus remembering the start of the U.S. involvement in World War II. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, a coalition of civil society groups say at least 34 people were killed by rebels late Saturday in three villages in the northeastern province of North Kivu. The attack came following pledges by the government and the United Nations to reestablish security around the town of Beni, where armed groups and militias are vying for control of mineral resources. One civil society group reports machetes and axes were used in the latest attack on villagers, and the death toll may be three times as high. In the past, Congolese organizations blame the Allied Democratic Forces and National Army for the liberation of Uganda for similar attacks. On his Twitter account, Martin Kobler, head of the UN peacekeeping mission in Congo, condemned attacks and called for DRC forces and the U.S. peacekeepers, the UN peacekeepers, to respond. More than 250 people have been killed in attacks around Beni in the past 2 months. Meantime, the UN Refugee Agency says authorities in the DRC have suddenly closed a camp for internally displaced people, forcing them to leave and to go home. Lisa Schlein reporting now from the UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency says 2,300 people living in the Kiwanja IDP camp in the eastern Congolese city of Rutshuru have suddenly become homeless. It says people were forced to leave the camp on December 2nd without warning and told to go home. UNHCR spokesman William Spindler says his agency is greatly concerned about the people who were suddenly set adrift.
Within a day, all had been forced to leave the site and their makeshift shelters were burned to the ground. Many of the IDPs do not have homes to go back to and are worried that they will not be safe in their villages. In addition, many IDPs had planted crops and would like to harvest this before leaving.
Many displaced people living in IDP sites around Goma, the capital of North Kivu province, have voluntarily returned home since the DRC government defeated rebel group M23 in fighting last year. The UNHCR says it recognizes such voluntary returns as long as they are in compliance with international humanitarian and human rights law. However, the agency says the sudden closing of the camp in Kiwanja does not fit that category. It notes the DRC ratified an African Union treaty on the protection and assistance of internally displaced people in July. A UNHCR spokeswoman, Karin de Groel, tells VOA that regional authorities decided they would close the IDP camp because the improved security situation meant people could go home without risk.
The M23 rebels, which were the main reason that these people were displaced about a year and a half, 2 years ago, they have been brought back under control. So that's the argument of telling these people to go back. Our concern is that there are other militia groups in the area as well, and there is still lawlessness and banditry, sexual violence against women, meaning that one of the militias has been brought under control to a certain extent. Doesn't mean it's safe for people to go back.
The UNHCR says certain measures must be taken to help IDPs who are unwilling or unable to return to their villages of origin because of insecurity. The measures it recommends include providing livelihood opportunities in places where people are displaced. It says other solutions, such as local integration near the sites, also should be considered. The agency says ongoing conflicts in North Kivu have caused nearly 900,000 people to flee their homes. It says more than 200,000 of them are living in 60 sites. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
10th doctor in Sierra Leone has died of Ebola. Aya Solomon Konayima's death occurred late Saturday at an Ebola treatment center in Hastings, that is near Freetown, and came a day after two of his colleagues who died of the deadly virus as well. It is another blow to a fragile health system still recovering from a decade-long civil war in the 1990s. It's believed Sierra Leone had just one doctor for every 50,000 people in the year 2010, about 120 physicians in the entire West African country. On Saturday, the government announced two other doctors had died of Ebola. 11 doctors have been infected, and only one has survived. And a bit better news, Cuban doctor Felix Baez, who contracted Ebola in Sierra Leone, has returned home to Cuba, cured after 16 days, in a Geneva, Switzerland hospital where he received experimental treatments. And the World Food Program and the British military have been airdropping food by helicopter to residents of Sherbro Island and surrounding islands off the coast of Sierra Leone. Zainab Mansare is the senior WFP program assistant.
For them to have access to market, they have to use boat, and then they go to like Freetown and the other main markets that are within the country in order to be able to sell their product and buy food. But with the Ebola situation, this has been put to a stop. They cannot travel. And in fact, like the fishes they have, which they have already catch from the sea, cannot be sold for them to have exchange of food. So with this, the need is really there, because if they cannot go out to market to buy, how can they have access to food? So on that basis, there is need for us to give them food so that whilst they have this food, they will be able to think properly, and then the situation being addressed can get access to market.
Zainab Mansare is a senior World Food Program assistant. Food security efforts in the Ebola-stricken countries has gotten a financial boost. It seems that the African Solidarity Trust Fund has awarded a $1.5 million grant to support farmers and those living in rural areas. However, the grant is only a fraction of what UN agencies say is needed. VOA's Joda Kapwa reports.
The trust fund, managed by the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, opened for business in 2013 with donations from several African countries. It currently finances projects in 30 nations. Ariella Glini is senior program advisor for the Global Food Security Cluster, which is co-led by the FAO and the World Food Program.
The Solidarity Trust Fund is a very particular trust fund where African countries come forward and put together resources to help development or emergency activities that support African countries. So from that perspective, it's unique. Now in the context of the joint effort to control Ebola and also the consequences and impact, it has just approved a contribution for the three most affected countries.
The Trust Fund's new $1.5 million grant will be equally distributed in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. It will support the UN agency's regional response program in assisting about 45,000 people over the next year.
The main focus of these activities is to assist households, and especially farming households, which have been affected by the impact of the Ebola crisis. It will also address social mobilization and training, so in terms of awareness, to stop the spread of the Ebola virus disease.
Glini explains why the program aims to strengthen the savings and loan mechanisms at the community level.
To kickstart some of the activities in terms of farming, marketing, which have been most affected. We have to keep in mind that the indirect effects of the Ebola crisis in terms of access to the fields, access to remote locations, the transport, the simple transport of goods and agricultural produce from one area to the other has been very heavily affected. And therefore, the saving schemes is considered to be one very instrumental support, especially for the communities which have to rely really much on their own resources and capacities.
The FAO and WFP will soon get the results of the latest food and crop assessments in the Ebola-affected countries.
These activities to consolidate the evidence, the available data and facts, not only the impact on the agricultural sector and production, but also the impact on livelihood and at community level. Of course, the focus remains on the health side to stop the spread of the virus, but actors come together also to mitigate or prevent some of the negative consequences of the virus.
Last month, the Food and Agriculture Organization appealed for $30 million to deal with Ebola's threat to food security. Glini says there's been little response so far.
The funding received from FAO side stands at a little more than $3.3 million. This leaves a major gap of over $26 million. A part of these resources FAO has provided from its own technical cooperation funding and internal resources.
Those internal resources include the new grant from the Africa Solidarity Trust Fund. FAO and WFP food security assistance is expected to continue in the Ebola-affected countries through 2015. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
And in Liberia, the nation's top court has issued a stay on a government order banning public gatherings in the capital, Monrovia, ahead of elections next week because of the risk of spreading Ebola. Presiding Associate Justice Philip Banks issued the stay pending two Supreme Court hearings that are scheduled this week. The court today is expected to hear arguments to delay the December 16th Senate elections until Ebola is eradicated. You can get more on the Ebola story plus the rest of the news of Africa by checking out our website at voanews.com.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military.
You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
and
civilians.
Sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians.
With all that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
Syria is accusing Israel of launching two airstrikes on it on Sunday near the Damascus International Airport and another near the town of Demas, close to the border with Lebanon. Syrian state television said the Israeli enemy committed aggression, as they put it, by targeting the two areas, but said there were no casualties. British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, with activists monitoring multiple battlegrounds inside Syria, said that 10 explosions were heard outside of a military area near Demas. Israel has carried out several airstrikes in Syria since the revolt against Syrian President Bashar al-Assad began nearly 4 years ago, but it has not acknowledged them and did not comment on the Syrian report on Sunday. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says international cooperation in the fight against the Islamic State militants could contribute to broader Middle East peace. And as State Department correspondent Scott Stearns reports for VOA TV, Secretary Kerry says the Obama administration is committed to better arming and training Syria's moderate opposition in that fight.
The fight against Islamic State militants in both Syria and Iraq is part of a broader battle for the future of the Middle East and security in Europe and the United States, a battle that Secretary Kerry says crosses ideologies and religions.
From the Sahel to the Maghreb, from Yemen to Syria, we are seeing an epic struggle take place in which dividers and destroyers are working overtime to drown out problem solvers, healers, builders, and where in too many places violent extremists are pursuing agendas of hate.
Kerry says the breadth of forces allied against Islamic State fighters shows encouraging signs for broader reconciliation in the Middle East.
The historic level of cooperation between Iraqi and Kurdish forces has resonated deeply in both communities. And the presence of Saudis and Emiratis and Jordanians and Qataris and others, all of them together facing this challenge now, is the sign of a new set of possibilities for regional engagement in security and counterterrorism and anti-extremism that may open new windows for all of us, including Israel, Palestinians.
Iraqi Foreign Minister Ibrahim al-Jafari says Islamic State fighters could be defeated by 2016, in part as a result of improving relations between Iraq and Saudi Arabia, as well as coalition airstrikes in both Syria and Iraq.
When the base of terrorism is raised in one country, the response and support comes from terrorist cells in a second country. So it is good that the international coalition has directed strikes on the terrorist enclaves in Iraq and at the same time is directing strikes against terrorism enclaves in Syria.
Syria's moderate opposition is under attack from both Islamic State fighters and government troops loyal to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Kerry says the United States is actively boosting its support for those rebels.
When it comes to their future, Syrians should not have to choose between a tyrant and the terrorists. Those are both dead ends. And that is why we favor a third option. The moderate Syrian opposition who are fighting both extremists and Assad every day.
Kerry says a meeting of the anti-Islamic State coalition in Europe last week resolved to keep up the fight, building on what he says has been significant progress over the last 2.5 months in disrupting militant financing, resupply, and command and control operations. Scott Stearns, VOA News at the State Department.
At least 70 Ethiopians drowned in the Red Sea. It happened Saturday when a cargo and a migrant boat bound for Libyan waters capsized in rough weather, adding to what was already a record year for maritime smuggling deaths. Security officials said heavy winds and waves battered the vessel before it sank off the port of Al-Makta in Taiz province. In October, the UN Refugee Agency declared 2014 the most dangerous in recent memory for migrants trying to reach Yemen by water. Also in the news, Pakistani security officials say a U.S. drone strike on a Taliban compound in North Waziristan has killed at least 4 militants, included a wanted, senior al-Qaeda leader, and wounded 2 others. Military officials identifying one of the dead in Sunday's strike as Umar Farooq, a key al-Qaeda figure in Pakistan. Farooq was reportedly close to the group's former leader, Osama bin Laden, and current head, Ayman al-Zawahiri. Departing U.S. Defense Chief Chuck Hagel has told the remaining American troops in Afghanistan that they still have challenges to meet, even as their mission soon will shift from fighting Taliban insurgents to training Afghan troops. Mr. Hagel, who recently resigned, made a final stop in Afghanistan Sunday, telling U.S. troops at the base near the eastern city of Jalalabad that the job's not over, in his words. The U.S. invaded Afghanistan in October of 2001 to overthrow the Taliban regime that harbored al-Qaeda fighters responsible for the terrorist attacks on the U.S. that occurred a month earlier. The U.S. and its NATO partners are withdrawing most of their troops from Afghanistan by year's end, leaving 12,500 American military personnel to train their Afghan counterparts. Secretary Hagel said Sunday, ultimately, no matter what the extent of U.S. military involvement in Afghanistan and Iraq, for that matter, might be, people in both countries must take responsibility for their own fate.
Our role is different in Iraq as it is here. In the end, each country must take the responsibility for their own future.
That is outgoing U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
On Sunday, Americans remember the December 7, 1941 attack on the American naval base at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, by the Imperial Japanese Navy. On that day, 5 U.S. battleships sank and were severely damaged, several hundred warplanes were destroyed, and more than 2,400 people died. It was the most devastating foreign attack on U.S. soil until the 2001 terrorist attacks. Here's VOA's Faith Lapidus.
Historian Craig Shirley was born more than a decade after the end of World War II, but he says the war was ever present as he grew up.
I grew up in a family and in a culture where the point of reference for everybody in conversation was before the war, during the war, or after the war. And everybody in my family had been involved directly in the war effort, whether it was civilian or military.
President Franklin Delano Roosevelt had resisted joining the war in Europe. He had been reelected to a third term. The nation was gradually climbing out of the Great Depression.
Franklin Roosevelt made public speeches to American mothers saying, "I'm not going to send your boys to fight in a European war."
But all that changed on December 7, 1941, when Japan attacked Pearl Harbor. In his book, December 1941, 31 Days That Changed America and Saved the World, Shirley dedicates each chapter to a day starting on December 1st. On December 8th, FDR addressed a joint session of Congress with his famous speech that began,
"Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan."
Everything stopped at about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and everybody gathered around their radios in their homes, in their libraries, in their churches. There were radio repair stores all over America that had radios out front of their stores and would have them on for passersby to listen to. The stock market closed. Everybody stopped to listen to the President of the United States.
40 minutes later, Congress declared war against Japan. On December 11th, Germany declared war on the U.S., and America joined the battle.
It was more of a, well, I guess we've got to get into this over there after all.
Going to war, Shirley says, changed America.
Women built airplanes and tanks. They learned how to become firefighters.
The nation's capital changed overnight.
Tens of thousands of civilians and military personnel come into the city. New buildings spring up every place. All the federal buildings have machine gun nests on top of them. There are Navy and Marine armed guards stationed at the entrance to every federal building in Washington, the Capitol, the White House, the State Department.
While Craig Shirley focuses mostly on what happened in the United States, another book gives an international perspective, focusing on 12 days only.
The 12 days are really pivotal in terms of the war as a whole and in the 20th century as well.
Evan Maudsley is a history professor at the University of Glasgow. He wrote December 1941, 12 days that began a world war.
In fact, the Japanese attacked the British before they attacked Pearl Harbor by about half an hour when they attacked Malaya. And the reason why they attacked Pearl Harbor is because they want to make sure the American Navy can't intervene in their invasion of Malaya.
Maudsley says the world after December 7th became fundamentally different from the world just one day before.
America as a global power, the real beginning of that, I think, does date back to the shock of Pearl Harbor. And up until this time, the whole fate of the world is determined by European powers. And from the first days of December, all of a sudden, the way the world operates has become global. You could argue, I think, that globalization almost dates back to this period of time.
Maudsley shows that December 1941 is not only still relevant, it indeed changed the world. For writer Faiza El Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News, Washington.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English. And also in the news, Britain's Prince William, his wife Kate, arrived for their first ever visit to New York on Sunday on a trip combining official business plus some old-fashioned tourism. Kate, also known as the Duchess of Cambridge, will tour a New York City Child Development Center today along with the wife of the mayor, Bill de Blasio. William will be here in Washington to meet with President Obama at the White House. He'll also be speaking at a world conference, a World Bank conference. The two will reunite later on, and they will also attend a fundraiser for the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, the school where the couple met while students. It is time to say goodbye. Thanks for tuning in to the Voice of America, an international edition. For the director of this program, Tracy Carter, the engineer, Dave Magnus, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
This is Today in History. On December 8th, 65 BC, the Roman poet Horace was born in southern Italy. In 1542, Mary Stuart, known as Mary Queen of Scots, was born. Mary would eventually lay claim to the crowns of Ireland and France, but when her claim to the English crown threatened Queen Elizabeth I, Mary was imprisoned and eventually beheaded. On this day in 1660, in a production of Shakespeare's Othello, Margaret Hughes starred as Desdemona in a groundbreaking performance. It was notable because she was the first woman to act on the English stage. Before that, boys played all of the female roles. On this day in 1813, one of the world's best-loved pieces of music debuted. Ludwig van Beethoven's Seventh Symphony premiered in Vienna. In 1854, Pope Pius IX proclaimed that Mary, the mother of Jesus, was conceived free of original sin. This Roman Catholic teaching is known as the Immaculate Conception. In 1941, President Roosevelt gave his famous Day of Infamy speech to Congress, calling for a declaration of war against Japan for its surprise attack on the American fleet at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. Also in 1941, Japanese forces invaded Malaya, Thailand, Hong Kong, the Philippines, and the Dutch East Indies. In 1974, a plebiscite formally abolished Greece's monarchy. The already exiled King Constantine II had left the throne the year before when a military junta effectively ended the monarchy. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A spate of global humanitarian crises has strained the United Nations International Food Aid Program, forcing the agency to sharply reduce food rations to 500,000 refugees sheltered in Kenya. On November 14th, the United Nations World Food Program announced that, as a result of insufficient funding, it would be forced as a last resort to cut in half provisions distributed to men, women, and children living in camps around the East African nation. The refugees, many who have fled conflicts in Somalia and South Sudan, will now receive a daily food ration of just over 1,000 calories in cereals, pulses, and oil. The WFP said that because of emergencies it is dealing with simultaneously in South Sudan, the Central African Republic, Syria, the countries surrounding those states, and countries in West Africa struggling with a massive outbreak of the deadly Ebola fever, it does not have the money needed to provide full daily rations for the refugees in Kenya. The strain is not focused on Kenya alone. Unless more support from donor nations is forthcoming, the WFP may have to cut rations in Ethiopia, where some 600,000 refugees have fled from violence in the region. The United States is profoundly concerned about funding shortfalls being experienced by humanitarian organizations in many places around the world. But nowhere is this shortfall more dire than it is in Africa. From October 2013 to October 2014, our nation has provided more than $5 billion in humanitarian assistance around the world. For refugees in Kenya during that period, U.S. humanitarian aid totaled over $111 million. We welcome the important contributions the United Kingdom and Denmark recently announced for Kenya and urge other countries and entities to make further donations as well to address the growing food insecurity for refugees both in Kenya and worldwide.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.